everybody. It's Jennifer Loudon, and I'm here with Sarah Selecki. And I'm just delighted. I was so excited to see your name on my calendar this morning and that we get to have a conversation about writing. And for those of you who don't know Sarah, oh, my gosh, have you been missing out. She's the author of This Cake is for the Party, a brilliant book of short stories that won all kinds of prizes. And she has two online writing programs that, one of which I've done called The Story is a State of Mind, and another one which is offered once a year, which is called The Story Intensive. And we'll talk more about those as we get into our conversation. What I really love about reading Sarah's stuff and Story is a State of Mind is the clarity and the lucidity, Sarah, that you bring to writing. There's a way that you know, you capture exactly what great writing is when you're talking about how to be a great writer. And that's really incredibly happy-making and helpful for me. So I just want to thank you for that.
Oh, thank you. That's a really kind thing to say, and it hits, like, it strikes me well. It's if there's one thing that I want to do when I wake up in the morning, it's bring clarity, like, to myself, but to my writing, too. So thank you. Thank you.
You do. I was thinking today, I don't know whether I learned it from you or I learned it someplace else and just saw reading through your blog to prepare for this interview that you also do this thing where you have people on retreat, and I'm about to go and lead my Taoist retreat, write down 10 things that they've encountered that day. And what I do is try to do this first thing in the morning when we do writing practice to get people warmed up, but also to help them start to pay attention and use sensory detail.
Yeah.
And I just love the way you described it. It was so meaty and delicious. Like, don't mediate it. Don't talk about how it made you feel. Like,
all right. Well, what's surprising is how difficult that is. It's surprising how difficult that is for writers.
Yeah.
I don't think it is for other people, but for writers, I think it's hard for us to stop writing it.
Right.
And
writing
just observe
it. To stop writing about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to just jump in right there. I've been working for almost 2 years now on and off on a think what's going to be a book. It started with a talk that I gave a couple years ago, and I used the haiku, the very well-known haiku, Barns Burned Down. Now I can see the moon, to frame the times in my life when I burned down a barn of something, a relationship, a business, or a barn was burned down around me, like my marriage, and then how I found a moon. And it started this whole process of realizing that when I gave the talk, I thought I was super good at change. Oh, my God, I'm so good at change. And as I've written into it, I'm like, I so suck at change. I have no idea what it means to burn down a barn. and so anyway, but part of what I've been struggling with, and this is where you come in, is to take this supple mind, as Philip Lopez says, trying to explore these ideas, and then getting the sense of what I'm about, and then bringing it back into sensory details. It's the exact opposite of what I do when I attempt to write fiction, which is you're like visualizing it. But here I'm.
Think it's the exact opposite? Say that again. It's the opposite of what?
Well, so when I have tried to write fiction over the years, I do visualize what's happening and try to describe it versus trying to figure it out. But in writing this project, I'm trying to figure out what the frickin' hell do I even mean about burning down the barn of my marriage?
Right.
And while I keep trying to bring it back to scene, there's a push-pull that's happening between showing and telling. And something reading over your blogs yesterday made me wonder, I wonder if we could talk about that. I don't even think that's a question.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's great. It's a great question because I think that because I come across this push-pull myself when I'm writing my newsletters and my blogs, like that dissolve into image that I can bring about, that I'm well practiced in my fiction when I'm writing a letter to somebody about something that has an idea that I want to express that actually has some, that I actually do want it to be a quote unquote meaning piece. I mean, that's the thing, like, you never want to write a meaning story, right? That knocks someone over the head with a meaning. You don't, you want to let it, but when I'm writing to the people, to my subscribers and to my readers, and wanting to teach them something about writing, I find that I get into that push-pull as well. And it's a lesson I have to learn over and over and over again, which is actually that it's the same. It is the same work. It's the same thing. There is an element of dissolving that needs to happen, and like the ego dissolving is what I'm talking about, I guess. I don't know. I'm using these words as though I understand psychotherapy. I don't, but from what I understand, there's a dissolve of self into what is known on a body level, in a body level. Even when you're talking about an idea, your body knows something about that idea that your mind doesn't. And it does. It just does. And it's not something that you may know in words right away. And that's the alchemy of writing. That's why writers are, you know, historically anyway, such powerful people. I mean, because they can create this magic, which is something that has not been articulated, that may not even be able to be articulated, and then embodying it and then putting it into words, and through the way those words are put down, like the way they come to you, there's something magical in it, where you leave language, and then you come back, you express something, and you feel something in your body, and then you bring it back into language. Mm-hmm. And it feels counterintuitive, especially when you're writing something that's nonfiction, or something that's a lesson, or something that is that you feel that is very important, like capital I important. You feel like it's counterintuitive to let go of the strings, or the scaffolding, or whatever the metaphor is that you'd like to use. You feel like losing control would be the exact opposite thing that you need to do in order to get your message across. Mm-hmm. And because fiction is my playground, I've practiced that trust more, so I think I'm more familiar with the feeling of letting go, and that it's a pleasure to do so in scene. And I'm not as practiced in the nonfiction world with letting go of control and feeling it as being playful. But it actually is the same thing. It is the same feeling of knowing something, feeling it in your body, leaving language in order to fully taste that and experience. I'm saying taste. It's just one sense, but I mean taste in terms of, you know, smell and taste and feel and all the rest of it. Just what does it feel like in your body when you know that thing? Mm-hmm. Even if that's, you know, I don't know, let's think of something. Like what does it feel like? The barn burning is great. That's great. So what does it feel in your body when you think about things in your life that equate burning down a barn? And then starting from there. And then just start writing from there about the feeling you have in your body when you know that thing, that ineffable thing. And then trusting what comes. And that's the piece that is so mysterious and difficult to, exciting to teach somebody and exciting to watch someone, very gratifying to help someone along in trusting that process, because it's always there for you. It's always there. It's not ever, you're never alone. Your subconscious has always got your back, always. It can't not. So it's just that relationship between you trusting it when you're not holding on to the ropes or not, and just trusting what you feel, really. And knowing, of course, then I'm going to, like, subtitle, you have to do the work behind that, which is reading and study and, you know, looking at the mechanics of how masters have done it and rereading and understanding. I mean, it doesn't come from nowhere. You have to install the language, the vocabulary, the syntax, the pacing, the tone, like all of that study has to come in. But then once you install it through reading it and studying it, you can just trust that it's there. And your language has got you, your subconscious has got you, and you can actually free fall, and it will hold, even if you don't understand it. That's the thing. You might not get it at first. You might not understand what you're writing yourself.
So one of the so that's fabulous and beautiful, and I'm wow.
So take that.
Take that barn burn down. Mm. In a little bit of applying that method, definitely not 100%. I've got ways to go. I have found that I have a lot of pieces, and now it's time to start to begin to create the structure and weave them together. And that is something that, even though I've studied structure since I was 19, is really difficult for me to make that leap between all those pieces that came out of the unconscious and weaving them together into a narrative whole. Again, because it's also a different form for me, and I would say it's somewhere between a memoir and a personal essay that we're talking about for this book.
Like long form
essays? Right. So the models I have are the four books that I've chosen are, where did I put them? Rebecca Solnit's The Field Guide to Getting Lost.
Love that book.
When Women Were Birds, Terry Tempest Williams. Appetites by Carolyn Knapp. And Devotion by Danny Shapiro.
Mm-hmm.
So three are much...
So interesting that you've got the soul knit in there.
Yeah.
When you're talking about structure.
Because structure is like...
Well, that's it, right? Like, so this is... I mean, I'll let you finish asking your question.
No, that's it. Go.
I'm speak out of turn.
I'm without questions. I'm just with scenarios.
Okay, because I do have something to say about this. Now, I've been studying structure, and I've been working on a novel, which is new for me for the past few years. And wow, what an incredible adventure this has been. And again, the less I thought that it would be different, and you know what? It's not. So many different. It's still about trust. It's still about installing something so that you know that you have it. So what you're doing, like with your models, is exactly where I would go to. So that's exactly what I would suggest. And then, you know, trusting that you have those models installed and then letting go and seeing what you've got. I don't know if you can know what your structure is until after you've finished writing the project. Similarly, too, you can't know what your story's about until after you've written it, because
that's
it's requiring...
So true.
Some sort of evolution on your part in order to finish something that's going to be transformative in any way. Like so the evolution has to happen from within, so you have to do the work of evolving while you do it. And that's really hard work. It's really uncertain, difficult, you know, all that butterfly cocoon, all that stuff. It comes into play when you're writing it. And I think it's really, I mean, there are various things that people do and have done that I recommend. I mean, ways to get past this that terrifying feeling of free fall, especially in something that's long form, where it's like you have to free fall for like the marathon of the length of a whole book, not just a story or an essay or a poem. Like you have to do it for months, if not a year, if not more than multiple years.
Yeah, if you're slow and have a million other projects going, years.
Well, that's the thing. And a lot of people, by the way, that's another trapdoor of how to write a long-form book, is to take breaks and write short-form things and do other projects in between, just so you have the feeling of, oh my God, I can finish something. Because it's good for the brain to feel like you can finish something. It gives you power. It gives you some, like, fuel. And
writing
it's good to see that,
really,
you know.
Helpful for that. The blog makes me feel good.
Yes.
It's like,
yes,
I wrote something. It made sense. People
look
read
how
it,
much
like...
you've written. Yeah, yeah. And you can see that evolution, that the book, like whatever your book is asking from you in terms of structure and story or otherwise and form, you can see when you take breaks to write smaller things that actually your writing is evolving. It is teaching. You are showing up for it. Mm-hmm. It looks like you're not doing as much work as you should because you're in the middle of this project. But when you step out and you give yourself the permission to write small things or finish small things on the side, you can see that you are evolving and you are learning, and it is teaching you something about who you are as a writer. And anyway, back to the Rebecca Solnit. Some things that you can do. One is copy other people's structure. Mm-hmm. It's a time-honored tradition.
Like, it is.
What are there, seven stories in the world? Like, copy someone else's point of view. Figure out how did someone else structure their book? Do that, and then guaranteed, if you show up honestly for your own work, you'll be writing your own story. It will be the original will be unidentifiable, and if it is identifiable, brilliant. It's part of the dialogue of literature. Bam, done. The second thing is, setting up some kind of scaffolding for yourself. Zadie Smith talks about this in one of her essays, where she used to keep her scaffolding in her novels, and then, you know, as she grew as a novelist, she realized that the scaffolding can come down. So the scaffolding could be, you know, there are going to be 27 chapters, one for each letter of the alphabet, or I'm going to start each one of these chapters is going to start with another color, but it's going to just be my own private project. I'm going to start each chapter with a color, or some kind of restriction, because restrictions breed creativity, right? So if it's all big and open, blah, what am I going to do? But if you can just impose little restrictions on yourself, use them as scaffolding so you can climb up and build the thing underneath it. What she said in her essay, which I loved, is that over the years she realized, oh, the scaffolding can come down. She didn't need that. It just helped her get the story out. And then once the structure is standing, you can take the scaffolding off and actually see what's under the scaffolding. And so, again and again, I keep coming back to that with my own work and when I teach writers, which is that you get comfortable with not knowing what it is before you write it, and understand, just like give way to the fact that you will figure out what your structure is in and through writing it. There's no other way. Unless you do these little cheats, which are totally great, but, you know, don't marry yourself to them, because they may hold that the story is much bigger than you are and much smarter than you are. Your book is much smarter than you are. So if you try to impose something upon it before it has told you what it really is, you will make it smaller than it is, and you don't want to do that either. So, you know, the onus is really on you to show up for how big this thing is that you don't understand, right? Like some surrender in place. But sorry, all this stuff to get back to one of your models for your book is the Rebecca Solnit. And structurally, I find her totally fascinating and so freeing, so permissive to just, I mean, she starts somewhere and then winds out and then follows her pen, follows the image, follows the chain, and then winds out again and winds out. And there is no, I mean, that's the pleasure, and she's writing so often about getting lost, right, and walking and just, like, losing oneself. So, and her structure reflects that so beautifully. And I think she's very loose on the scaffolding. I don't know. I'd love to ask her that, actually. But I would imagine that she's I feel from her work that she's well-practiced at getting out of her own way and just letting herself write something that doesn't have to make sense to her right away, because getting lost is part of her pleasure.
Although,
and that's what she writes
about,
you know.
I will say, when I read the next book, Far Away Nearby.
Far Away Nearby,
I didn't like it. I mean, the writing was extraordinary, but she got too loose, and it was too...
Yeah, yeah.
And the Field Guide to Getting Lost had more structure. So I've been
trying to compare
the two, like what... there's a way that it was too loose, and I didn't feel, I had a hard time finishing it.
So this is telling you something, right? This is telling you something about yourself. And the way we read is just like, it's our best teacher, what we read, and what our experience of, because, you know, to another reader, to another writer, to someone else at a different stage of his or her writing process, or like with something else to learn, it may have been flipped. It may be the opposite. If someone else has to show up in a different way, and his book or her book, writing it, is teaching her something else, then that experience could very well be flipped. What you like and what you don't like is teaching you so much about what you're working on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great that you know that and you see that, and that you've bundled the volume that you have in with the other volumes that you have. Like, that is telling you, that's a mirror for your book to be, which is great, really exciting that you know that. Because you can trust that. You can trust it. If you don't like it, you know, you got to write what you want to read. So if there's something about that too much looseness that you don't like, then yeah.
This is a great conversation. I'm having so much fun. But I don't want to make this all about me. So
right,
I want to
ask
questions that other people might want to hear.
What do other people want to know?
Well, one of the things that when I was first following you and reading you in the a few years ago when you started blogging maybe 4 years ago. So I was like, I really love this, but I have to translate it because I'm not a short story writer and I have no desire to be a short story writer.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, and I couldn't find the quote on the blog, but there was something about kind of, you know, this staunch defender for being a short story. And I was like, my mouth fell open when, however many months ago, you started talking about writing a novel. And I wanted to ask you, do you feel like a traitor?
I know. Someone actually recently, ha ha ha, teasingly actually said that to me. No. No, I don't. I feel like I needed to be obsessive about short fiction in order to write it.
Mm-hmm.
It was just how I worked. I needed to shut everything else down. And I didn't understand novels because I was too busy understanding short stories, and the focus benefited me so much. I still feel like there's no such thing as an impeccable piece, but a really great short story is life-changing in a similar way to, you know, a Mary Oliver poem can be life-changing. I can hold stories with me in a manageable way. Like, if I can hold a short story, if I can hold a poem in my pocket, I can hold a short story in my purse, you know, and carry it around with me as a talisman, whereas a novel is more of an experience that requires something of me that's different both as a writer and a reader. But as a writer, that experience of what it asked from me, I needed to learn. I don't know how else to say it.
Mm-hmm.
It has felt impossible at many stages, and then getting over that impossible hump to the next place where it feels like possible before he reaches the next impossible place has been really strengthening for me as a writer and a person. And I am still a staunch supporter of short fiction. I'm glad that I learned how to write through short fiction, because I think it made me pay attention to every single word in a way that, had I not had that training, I'm just glad I had that training. I'm glad that and I think I will go back. I'm really interested to, you know, Allie Smith writes a novel and a short story collection alternately through her publishing career. And I asked her about it once, and she too is a staunch supporter. It's the short fiction is like her great love. And she said that she needs to take breaks from short fiction because it's too intense.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand it until now. now I get it. It's just the intensity of short fiction was it's such a bright light. It was too hard for my eyes to look at it again after all that happened with my first collection.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm speaking around it. I guess I haven't figured out my soundbite for this yet. I'm glad you asked me. The first person to ask me while I'm being recorded. I'm embarrassed to listen to what I'm saying. But what do you think? How's that for an answer?
Well, you know, what I would extract from that for your soundbite.
Please,
is,
yep.
I follow where my learning and is taking me.
Yeah.
And I just want to step back for those of you who are listening who may not self-identify as writers but may think of yourself as creative entrepreneurs, that it could be really easy for Sarah to have said, I can't write a novel. Or if I am, I have to keep it a secret because my programs are all about short fiction. And so what I appreciate is, and again, it goes back to what I love about your work so much, is there's just a dedication to creative truth that would never even occur to you, I think, to subvert or hide.
I'm kind of incapable of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It crossed my mind. It did occur to me that people won't trust my program if they know that I'm working on a novel because they think the short story failed me in some way or something. But I quickly just overrode that because the truth is it didn't. The truth is it was the opposite. And the other thing is there were so many incredible short fiction collections that were coming out, and like in major arenas. I mean, I'm saying major lowercase m because in literature there's no major arena really. But you know, Oprah has been covering. She's been looking at short fiction collections. There was a short story collection that was her book of the year a couple years ago, The 12 Tribes of Hattie, and which is a great book. And I just felt like, okay. I don't need to be a crusader as much anymore because things have changed in the past 5 years for short fiction. And it's doing okay, especially with all the long form, like with what Netflix is doing and HBO and all these long form narratives, like television narratives. Short fiction has lent itself to television and film really well. So I know the producers and screenwriters are looking to short fiction. So collections are not as snubbed. I mean, the economy has been what has been snubbing short fiction for so long. So I came up as a crusader to be, you know, like, no, short fiction is marketable too. But in the past 5 years, the whole economy of fiction and publishing and writing in general has just, like, it's a crapshoot now. Like, it's just all, it's a free-for-all. So that's actually really great for short fiction. It doesn't need to strive as hard. I feel like it doesn't need to be striving as hard anymore because people now see that publishing is changing anyway. So the rules are different.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like I need to stick up for it as much. It's doing okay for now.
And the other thing I want to point out, again, just from a creative entrepreneurial point of view, is that, you know, the permission to continue for our own growth and learning. And I see so often, not so often, but I see often enough that people short-circuit that or overthink it because they're like, but I'm known for this, instead of allowing themselves to continue to grow. So I just want to point that out for everybody. That I find that really heartening and important and actually more than crucial.
You got to listen to, I mean, what did you get into this for? I mean, why?
Yes.
And why be a writer? I mean, if there was a ladder to climb in your career as an artist or an entrepreneur that was like preformed for you that you weren't making as you went along, would you be here anyway? Like, you'd probably reject it.
Anyway.
You've got to follow. Yeah, you got to follow it. It never leads you astray. You know, your creative instinct always is bang on, even when it looks completely irrational, even when your publisher tells you, you better get another book out soon, Sarah, because they'll forget about you if you don't. We've all read books that have, or seen work that's come out of a place of should rather than the natural growth spurt and period of someone's natural creative, chutzpah, or that's not the right word for it.
The creative
chutzpah, the natural process, which might be slower or bolder or, outlandish or quieter than whatever it is. We've been touched by the things that are honest. As readers, as observers, as participants, we're always touched with the stuff that's honest. And you can never outsmart that. You just can't, because it's smarter than your thoughts.
So I want to ask you about your writing life. One of the things it says on the website is that you teach the story intensive, that we can talk about in a moment, half a year. And then half the year you concentrate on your own writing. And so I'm so curious, as someone who is, you know, still running a business, I imagine, and answering questions and blogging. Mm-hmm. You know, do you really completely go offline for that 6 months or whatever year to attend to your own writing? Or
no.
How does it work?
No. Usually I do it in stages because I get addicted to technology like everybody. And usually once the story intensive, which is my main 4 month program that's done live, I'm present, my TAs are present, and I teach my students in live time. When that starts, I can go off Instagram, and I feel like I'm okay going off Facebook because I'm focused on the students in my class mm-hmm. at that point. And so I ease up first on the social media, and that kind of coasts. Everything slows down. Then when I go off social media, it's always a little bit antsy for the first week or so, and then my personality comes back and my creativity comes back, and it's like this nice reblooming effect. So from September to December, I really feel restored, and I put the energy that I put out into broadcasting during the summertime into my class and into my TAs and into my students, and that feels really good. And then when the story intensive closes and everyone graduates in December, we all take a break for the holidays, and then in January, with my team, and personally and in the school, both, we look at what we want the next year to look like, how when we want our time off, how we want to structure the year so that we're all of our self-care is met, so that our students are cared for, and so that our business is cared for. And we set all of that up in the calendar. And then after that, which is around the second week of January, I really go quiet. And then I start writing in January. Be generally pretty rusty, pretty cranky. It's pretty slow. I've done this enough now to not, you know, hopefully, touch wood. It's always hard each time, but like throw my hands and be like, I can't do this, which happens every time. I'm very dramatic that way. And then I get through that hump, and generally by February, I'm well into my writing flow again. I still come online for my newsletters. I still write all of my newsletters and those posts. But because I'm not teaching and because I'm not on social media, I have that amount of energy to give to that writing. And it's just a matter of, like, it doesn't feel like I have... I feel like there's a finite amount of creative juice that I can give, and I can't give it to my students, to my subscribers, to social media, and to my own writing all at once. So I break the year up into, like, sort of three sections of 4 months each, generally. Mm-hmm. And one is just self-care and, like, living life and paying attention to my husband and the nature and the air and taking things in and not actually stressing about getting anything done. Vacation, otherwise known as holiday. There's a little bit of that. And then there's a good chunk of business time, 4 months, that I just really give to the running the school. And that's really in launch time. It's not when I'm teaching, because when I'm teaching and I'm not launching and I'm not running so much of the business aspect of, and you know what launching is like all of that takes a lot of bandwidth. If I'm teaching and I'm not using that bandwidth, the teaching is actually quite restorative for me, and it's healthy and it's good. And as long as I have also given my book its requisite 4 months, and it knows that its next requisite 4 months, and it trusts me to give it that time each year, because that's one thing. It's taken me a little while to really, you know, keep my word to my own writing, and I think a lot of writers struggle with this because it's not it doesn't demand your time as loudly as anything else. So it's easier to break your own promises, and I mean with any creative work or anything. I mean, this is where resistance comes in and all the rest of it, but. If you actually do, and now I am, and I do, I feel like I've cracked that part of the code at least. If you do what you say you're going to do, your writing will hold, and it will hold its space for you, and it's not going to be as painful going back to it. Mm-hmm. So as long as I know, and my writing knows, that I'm going to give it 4 months at the beginning of the year, every year, then I can freely teach without any without any shadow feelings around that, giving that energy to my students. Mm. It feels really good because I know that I'm going to refill that well right away with my own work, for my own work. So that's the rhythm. It moves
really
here and there.
Question. I have a really important question.
Yeah. Okay.
What about email?
Yeah. I go off email a lot.
So during those 4 months that you're writing your book, do you like go off email entirely?
No, but I treat it like, you know, if you really need to get in touch with me, call me. Mm-hmm. And if you don't feel like calling me, it's probably not that important. I lose a lot of opportunities. Like, I get invited to things that I just drop. I just let it drop. Mm-hmm. And it helps if I'm in another time zone. That this year I was in Europe for those months, and it helped me immeasurably because I wasn't even awake when the things were coming in. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even have that pull. I have an autoresponder on that really clearly says, I'm into slow communication, and I'm writing my book, and I advise you to do the same. And if something is, you know, if someone is going to be in physical pain as a result of me not answering this email, call me. Otherwise, it's okay, because writing my book is more important. It actually is more important because there is physical pain that comes if I don't write it, to me. You know, by proxy, everyone around me. So it really is the most important thing. And nobody, and you know, if you don't understand, that's okay. Like, people might get upset. They don't really, though. They get it. You know, the next thing fills their inbox. They forget that they even emailed me more often than not. And you know, I get a lot of beautiful, beautiful handwritten letters in the mail. I have pen pals who I have met through my autoresponder days. And it brings me so much pleasure to sit down with beautiful piece of stationery when I'm taking a break from my book and just write about, you know, where I am and respond to a letter. I write by hand. I write letters to people instead. Mm. It's slow mail. And I miss out on a lot of stuff. I do, definitely. Like, I don't get it all done. I don't answer it all. I drop the ball. It doesn't all get done. Mm-hmm. And I'm a more well-balanced person, mm-hmm. even though that everything doesn't get done. Mm-hmm. It seems counterintuitive to me, the person who likes checking things off lists. It really does. But, the email slows down. Like, when people just know that you're not answering,
it's true.
They just, you know, they stop eventually.
Yeah, yeah.
And people, you know, they've learned to expect it from me now that I just drop off. And, you know, it's not nice. Like, it maybe makes me less likable, but not really. I'm like, no, I'm still likable. It's okay. It's okay to just not answer emails.
So what
you know what I do sometimes, Jennifer? You know what I do sometimes? Yeah. I have a folder called Not Urgent. So when stuff comes in and I don't want to answer it because they've already received an autoresponder to me, but it feels like something that has urgency, and all that urgency is coming from the sender, me. It's their urgency. Mm-hmm. Like, can you come to this conference? I have a panel. It's going to be amazing. Can you speak on this panel? This would be amazing. I put it, I can't archive that. I can't not respond to it. What I'll do is put it in non-urgent. Non-urgent is my own little brain trick. I never respond to anything. It's non-urgent. It's just, oh, they just all are there, but they're invisible to me. It's basically like archiving it, but it makes me feel like I'm not being as nasty.
But that, you broke up just a little bit on that, but I think what I heard, just
sorry,
to repeat it. That's okay. You must be calling in with Skype, and maybe Skype's being a little funky.
Oh, I'm on my landline because I didn't want that to happen. I wonder what, maybe an airplane flew overhead for the...
Maybe plane flew overhead. So you put it in a non-urgent file. And it calms your brain down, even though you never answer
it. It calms my brain down.
I really
yes,
like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah. It calms my brain down, and then I forget about it. And they forget about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, opportunity lost, but so much.
Right, because there's, you know, your priorities. So one of the things that I work with when I'm working with writers a lot is helping them make the distinction and the jump from free writing /journaling, and, you know, knowing that there's a difference between them, but it's a slippery slope sometimes for people to understand the difference, and really mm-hmm. beginning to write for a reader and craft for a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved what I, as I was poking around in your blog, when you wrote, free writing without attention is a crapshoot. Your craft
yeah.
lives in your attention.
Yeah.
So I wonder if we could just riff for a little bit about some pointers for people who are like really trying to understand what the difference is between keeping their pen moving and actually beginning to craft a short story or an essay or a blog post.
Yeah.
For example.
Yeah. Well, the beautiful thing about this is that it can be learned. I love this. It can be, it, you can learn how to do it. And, you know, there's so much mystery around the writing process, but this is one thing that actually is a craft that can be taught. Isn't that great? The first step, of course, for many people is learning how to free write, because learning how to not control your words and let them spill out, get in the way of editing them and everything is really, really important so that you can see the things that are coming to you without you blocking them by criticizing them or jumping them down in some way. You know, it's a really important skill. But if you stop there, you'll end up feeling lost and frustrated, because why aren't these turning into stories? Why aren't these turning into why does this just? I mean, there are a few good glimmering images in there, but what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
And this is study, and this piece. This is I think what workshops do, what some workshops can do really well. It's what good MFA programs or good writing teachers can teach if they are benevolent sorts. They can teach, you know, through attending to what you read and seeing first what you love to read, and then understanding the mechanics of writing. And it's a craft like any other craft. There are tools. In language, there's point of view that does something. Pacing, syntax, all the stuff in sentence structure. It's a great book, How to Write a Sentence by Stanley Fish. An incredible book for anyone who wants to study writing craft and see what it means to look at the mechanics of a sentence and see what a sentence is doing. Because it's not just... A strong sentence is actually an active thing. As much as a brushstroke on a canvas in a different color or a different medium is provoking a certain emotional affect, so too does your syntax, the verbs you choose, where you put the verb, you know, all this stuff about just the sentence itself. And that you can study and learn and memorize and practice and recognize as you're reading. You can see, oh, this person's using... I mean, it's only invisible at first. And then once you start paying attention to something like point of view, let's say, if you start paying attention to first-person point of view versus third-person limited, so I voice versus he or she, once you start paying attention to that and seeing how what an author can do with a first person by telling a story in I, and the intimacy that's gained there, but then also the limitations that, because it's only from that person's point of view, you can only write something from that person's voice and only use the language that person is using. You can only use metaphors that character would ever think of using. Otherwise, it rings flat. So once you see that in the stuff you're reading, you can start playing with it and practicing it and, you know, really copying it. I mean, copying it. You copy what you read first to find out what you write. And then when you start to see, oh, what the limitations of third person are, huh, I get to say all this, I get to use this other voice, I get to use vocabulary that the characters perhaps wouldn't use in real life, but I get to say what I want to say by using that. But at the same time, there's a certain amount of intimacy that's lost, therefore, how will I regain that intimacy? Maybe I'll, you know, what other tools do I have to use? And then you can look into why metaphor? Why would you use metaphor and not use metaphor? I mean, there's so much. This is the whole wealth of creative writing instruction, is that. So, and the attention part is required. I mean, if you I took a sewing class a couple years ago. I wanted to sew a skirt, so I went to this like sew by the hour place, lovely place in my old neighborhood in Toronto, and worked with a seamstress. And gosh, I did not know that there was so much math involved in sewing. I mean, you have to, it is unforgiving. It is not like knitting. It is every quarter inch is like and you have to pay attention to where your blades are snipping. Otherwise, you'll, like I did, cut it in the wrong place, and then either make your skirt is shorter forever, or you have to sew something else on. Writing is much more forgiving than that, but that's the kind of thing, that's what I mean by attention. You have to know what your blades are. You have to know where your rotary is. You have to know what your fabric is, know what the color of the lining of the skirt will be. That's the kind of attention. That's the craft. Mm-hmm. It's not all a free-for-all. You're not just like, throwing, even a crazy quilt, a quote-unquote crazy quilt, has attention in all, like the seams need to be the same, the seam allowance needs to be the same width. And that's craft. You can learn it. It just takes practice. If you have this is why I love teaching, this is what I love watching them do through Story State of Mind, which is how I built Story State of Mind. It starts with freeing up so that you know how to lose control. And then it starts teaching you how to pay attention to the craft. And then through the reading and through the practice and continuing to let go while at the same time toning your muscles of attention, while toning your muscles of letting go at the same time, which is, that's the work of it. I mean, that's why this stuff is so hard, because you have to do both at the same time. Mm-hmm. But through that, yes, you can learn. If you have a story to tell, like if you are a writer and you know that you're a writer, and writers kind of all have this feeling that they know that they're, I've found, whether at whatever age they are, the pull, the draw to use language to create something is in every writer who I've taught, and they learn it, they get it. Like, you can get attention is practice. It's a practicable skill. You can it works. You can do it. It's not something, that's not the magic. The magic is, do you really love using language to communicate something that has no words? That's the magic part. But if you've got that down, the rest of it can be learned. It takes time. It takes time, and other people around you may not understand how much time it takes, so you gotta love it. But it really is a brilliant feeling once that muscle starts getting stronger, because you can surprise yourself. You can surprise yourself by how much you know and how much you've let go, so how in the letting go you can show yourself what you didn't know that you knew, if that's not too tangled.
No, I like it. I like it. I like it. Which was a really nice segue to talking about story as a state of mind and the story intensive. Is a question I've always wanted to ask, and I don't know why I haven't, is, does everyone who takes the intensive focus only on short fiction?
No. In the course, their culminating assignment is a piece of short fiction, yes.
Okay.
But that a lot of writers are working on something else, are working on their own project on the side that may be longer. A lot of people working on memoir who get a lot of because I think especially with memoir, and I've never written a long form memoir.
You were just breaking up a tiny bit again.
Sorry.
That's okay. I want to hear your every word.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'll repeat myself. There are a lot of students, a lot of writers who work especially in memoir novels as well. But the memoirists are interesting to me because perhaps because I have not written, I haven't tried to write that form, so I've been curious about how they've put stories of state of mind to their own work. And I think it's like so many things, it just comes back to that. Like, if you attend to the details and the craft, you can create the art. I mean, there's anything that you learn about dialogue, story, or image and scene, and you know, where to put exposition versus scene or dialogue and all that. That, of course, works in memoir as well because it's storytelling. It's storytelling. Storytelling is storytelling. Mm-hmm. I find that a piece of short fiction is a really gratifying, edifying piece to finish at the end of a four-month course, which is why I ask everyone to do that. Mm-hmm. And it works. And, you know, it is the experience of writing something and finishing something and then going back and rewriting it and finishing it and then showing it to someone else and having their feedback on it that it's quite galvanizing to any writer, I think, at any whatever project you're working on. It feels like you can see what you've learned and then you can put it into practice with whatever you're working on. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me, as we're coming to a close, what's the experience like inside the intensive? Paint me a picture.
Oh, my gosh.
What it looks like.
What it looks like? So not just it's intense. It's intense, but it's exhilarating. It looks like an online forum. So it looks like an online classroom. Every TA sort of has her own flavor. I let each of my TAs teach the way that best reflects their own style and voice. So each classroom looks a little bit different depending on who builds it, but all of them have the same elements, and I try to make everything as clean as possible. I like to teach in a white room that's full of daylight. So I'm always just trying to make the digital space feel the same. There are live calls, so we speak like this on the phone. We don't do video because I find that telephone is better for introverted writer types, and it's easier to focus on what's being said. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time spent in the intensive is actually spent on stories of state of mind, because that is the basis, that's the foundation for the intensive. So the whole time spent in the story of state of mind classroom is, it looks like a lot like my website, that part does. So color for the beautiful color for each of the lessons, and some clean video for when I have video thing when I need to say something in person, I step in with video, and otherwise there's just a lot of space left for the students to be themselves and to bring themselves to the space.
Yeah. And then does each of the TAs have a separate, like, pod where people are commenting and they're commenting, or is everyone commenting and seeing each other's work?
The classes are small.
Does the whole group come together?
The whole group comes together a few times to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And TAs sometimes come on that call as well. And I get to be in touch with everybody one-on-one that way, and everybody comes on, and I space those out so everyone in the different time zones hopefully gets a chance to get on that call with me. And then the students are in their small group with their TA, 6 to 8 people in each group, really tight, and you get really close with that group of people. And then I work closely with my TAs, so I know what's going on in each classroom through my TAs that way. The writers are in really good hands with very focused, I mean, you get one-on-one attention. And if there's any question that a TA has or that a writer has for me through the TA, I speak with my TAs for each lesson, so 8 times through the course of the 4 months, and they directly ask me, and then we get in touch that way. There's lots of opportunities to be in touch because I have these small classes, which is really nice. So nobody gets lost. Everyone, if you don't show up for class, you're missed. Like someone called you on it. You're meant to be there. Everyone's depending on you.
Perfect. I love it. I love it. Is there anything else you'd like us to know about Story of a State of Mind or the Story of a State of Mind intensive?
You know, what I'm really, and I've said this somewhere on my website, but I do just, I'm really coming to it because as I'm getting ready to open registration for it next month, and so I'm going over all of the feedback that I read from my graduates last year, and again, and the thing that I'm really, really proud of, and of course also reading, you know, hearing from my TAs about what they gained from the experience working with their students, and then working, reading from the students and hearing what they gained from the experience of working with each other and with the TAs. What I love about the Story Intensive and what I'm really proud of, and why I, why I'm so fierce about this work, like putting my, why I put my novel aside in order to do this, mm-hmm. because I really feel strongly that it teaches the craft. It teaches the, it's serious. It's for serious writers. And it really is an in-depth look at the mechanics of good writing at a deep level that, you know, because I have so many readings included in it, and because there's an opportunity to discuss what these stories are doing and what this writing is doing, this like polished work, and because the focus is on articulating what is working, like really being able to, not just what I like and what I don't like and isn't that good, but like what is it? Like that, yeah. Putting words to something that you didn't know how to describe before, that's the intense learning. But doing so in an environment that's so positive, it's not everything you write is going to be good. It's not that. You're going to learn. I love that my students have learned themselves and from each other what their own voice can do for them, what their own writing can actually do for them. What I'm proud of is that no one is left behind in this program. This program shows me that there is actually a lot of room in this world for all writers who want to write. There is no shortage, and this is something that, you know, competitive programs, you know, the publishing world is competitive, and media is competitive, and the MFA programs are very competitive, and contests are competitive, and there's it's competitive, and there's a certain amount of healthy competitiveness that brings about the best in some of us, but behind all of that, there's actually room for art. Good, honest art needs to be made. And what I'm proud of in the Story Intensive is that it actually shows writers how to do it. Mm. Like, it really does. It really does. If you're serious about writing, you will gain a lot from this. If you put your nose to it, you'll gain a lot of skill from it that will last, because it teaches you how to live a writing life, how to live a life as a writer, as well as the skill that you need to create some good writing. And those two things together, I feel, are rare in the writing programs that I've been lucky enough to attend. You know, I haven't been able to find that channel that satisfies me, which is why I made the intensive to do it.
Teach what you want to teach, as well as write what you want to read. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, incredibly helpful, brilliant conversation. I love talking to you. I feel so much. I want to go write right now.
Me too.
So thank you so much. Everybody listening, make sure if you want to check out the intensive that you, if you've downloaded this, so you come back to the blog and check out what I have to say about it, and click on the links and learn more. And Sarah, it's just wonderful to be in your presence and talk about writing with you. Really exciting and very nourishing.
I love talking to you. I always love talking to you. It's just as filling for me. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.